happy birthday today to Mavis G. McVitie of Des Moines, to Jim Snowberger of Marshalltown, to Margaret Hoffman of Urbandale, and to Paul Gaffney of Des Moines. Happy birthday to all of you. I hope you're having a great day today. You're joined in your birthday today by newsman Sam Donaldson, who turns 90 today, and musician Bobby McFerrin, who turns 74. If you are listening to Iris on your television or Iowa Public Television, if you're listening to Iris on your television, it would be on an Iowa Public Television channel. And if you are doing that but are not a registered Iris user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. As you know, you are listening to Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Be sure to call us if you are not on our list, because we need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. We have only one obituary today, and here's it is with Nicole.
We would like to remember Donald Minx today of Des Moines. Donald Lee Minx Sr., 76 years old, passed away peacefully on March 8th under hospice care, surrounded by his loved ones. Don was born on August 4th, 1947 in Des Moines to Max and Helen Minx. Visitation will be happening on Wednesday, March 13th at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens Funeral Home from 5 to 7 p.m. There's also a rosary at 7 p.m. A Catholic Mass will be held on Thursday, March 14th at the All Saints Catholic Church at 10 a.m. Please visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com to leave a condolence and also to see the full obituary. You want to continue on with some headlines, or would you like me to do that? Okay, so here's Twyla with the next headline in the main section of the Register.
Thanks, Nicole. Biden hits swing states and launches a major ad buy. This is Dateline Washington. Fresh off a fiery State of the Union address where he targeted his likely opponent by everything but name, President Joe Biden is in campaign mode. The president has embarked on a tour of battleground states that began with Pennsylvania on Friday and Georgia over the weekend. His reelection campaign is launching a six-week, $30 million ad buy, opening more than 100 offices across the country and hiring more than 350 new staff members. His campaign, for the first time this cycle in New Hampshire on Monday, and visit the critical swing states of Wisconsin and Michigan on Wednesday and Thursday. Biden's blitz follows former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's exit from the GOP race after a string of losses in Super Tuesday primaries, pushing former President Donald Trump nearer to his party's nomination. The president's campaign said it raised $1.5 million in the 24 hours after Super Tuesday's primaries, which also forced out Biden's top challenger for the Democratic nomination, retiring Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota. Thursday was the best fundraising day for Biden's campaign since he announced his reelection bid. The jump in donations came after Biden's combative and at times boisterous State of the Union address. His team is now making its largest ad purchase of the 2024 campaign to date. We're already seeing people tune in over the last couple of weeks around these key moments where they are seeing and paying more attention to the fact that there is a choice. It is us versus Trump, Biden campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon said. People are starting to every day check into a little bit more, pay a little more attention, and take action, she said. Biden, on Thursday evening, came out swinging against Trump in the House chamber. He started and ended the annual primetime address with references to his predecessor as he began to campaign to bring home wayward Democrats and reel in Trump-averse Republicans. The president is bringing people together, fighting for more freedom and democracy, building an economy that grows up from the middle out and the bottom up, while Donald Trump is running a campaign of revenge and retribution for himself and his wealthy friends, Biden deputy campaign manager Rob Flaherty said on Friday.
And now here's a little fun story. Rare total eclipse in April, accessible for millions. The sky is filled with breathtaking wonders, but one occurring on April 8th is causing people to plan trips in droves, prompting fears of snarled highways. The total solar eclipse on April 8th is causing such a stare because of the rare causing event, where the window of the moon will be plunge a narrow strip of land into darkness in the middle of the day, It's an astronomical experience like no other that will be accessible to millions of people. April's total solar eclipse will fall over more places in the U.S. than the total eclipse before and after it, and the broad length of the path of totality, where Americans have the best shot of getting a clear view, is much wider than it was for the eclipse in 2017. This is according to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. I think that's NASA, right? Yeah. Okay, so the total solar eclipse is also far more impressive than a lunar one or an annular solar eclipse. During an annular eclipse, the moon covers the sun but leaves an outside ring that some call a ring of fire. It darkens the sky instead of plunging Earth into a night-like darkness, which is what happens during a total solar eclipse. Earth's shadow and then appears red. This is according to NASA. A post from NASA says the eclipse in 2024 could even be more exciting due to the differences in the path, timing, and scientific research. And like past similar natural phenomenons, the eclipse is expected to elicit a strong emotional reaction from the people who can see it. The next visible total solar eclipse to cross over the U.S. after April will come in more than two decades, on August 23, 2044, according to NASA. And that eclipse won't be as accessible as the 2024 one. The path of a totality in 2044 will only touch the states of Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota, according to the Planetary Society, a nonprofit involved in research, public outreach, and political space advocacy. Solar eclipses are rare in part because they can only occur during a new moon and when the moon's orbit is tilted 5 degrees to Earth's orbit around the sun. NASA estimates 215 million adults in the U.S. saw the 2017 solar eclipse, either in person or electronically, and even more people will see April's eclipse. The eclipse's path of totality will pass over cities like Dallas, Cleveland, and Buffalo, New York, and those places will attract sky gazers from all over the country. Searches for short-term Airbnb rentals around those areas have surged. Transportation officials in areas along the path of totality are warning residents and travelers that the eclipse could create dangerous and busy traffic conditions on roads around places with the best view. A study of the social effects after an eclipse shows that people who viewed the 27 eclipse in its path of totality experienced feeling like part of a collective more than those who were outside of the path. Researchers found that the astronomical events may play a vital collective function by arousing all and social tendencies that orient individuals toward their collectives. Okay, one quick thing here. Watching it electronically, isn't the whole point to go outside and see it in person?
Well, I would think so. I'm not sure what electronically is, just looking at it on your phone, right? Okay, ALS drug could be pulled after failed clinical trial. One of the few available drugs to treat amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, may get pulled from the market after failing a large clinical trial nearly 2 years after its controversial approval by the Food and Drug Administration. Phase 3 trial investigators found what was called no significant difference in patients who took the drug, called Relyvrio. This is spelled R-E-L-Y-V-R-I-O, and I'm going to call it Relyvrio. And let's start that again so it makes sense. Phase 3 trial investigators found no significant difference in patients who took the drug, called Relyvrio, compared with patients who took a placebo, according to a statement released Friday by the drug's manufacturer, Amylyx Pharmaceuticals. In the 48-week trial, the Cambridge, Massachusetts-based company enrolled 664 adults with ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. There is no cure for the disease, which gradually destroys nerve conditions needed for basic movements and eventually breathing. Most people die within 3 to 5 years of diagnosis. Justin Klee and Joshua Cohen, co-CEOs of Amylyx, said the company will continue to work with federal regulators and the broader ALS community to discuss results from the trial and decide Relyvrio's fate in the next 8 weeks. They may voluntarily withdraw the drug from the market, they said. In the meantime, the company has decided to pause promotion. We are surprised and deeply disappointed by the trial results, Klee and Cohen said. We will be led in our decision by two key principles, doing what is right for people living with ALS, informed by regulatory authorities and the ALS community, and by what the science tells us, they said. Relievio, a combination of sodium phenylbutyrate and torsodiol, was supposed to work by boosting cell energy and preventing a process that can lead to cell death. It was taken orally or through a feeding tube. Amid pressure from patients unwilling and unable to wait for a years-long review process, the drug received full FDA approval after a small mid-stage study in which the disease appeared to progress more slowly, with patients surviving several months longer. Normally, the agency requires two large studies or one study suggesting a very persuasive improvement in survival. Several other drugs have been approved to treat ALS, the most recent in 2017, but none has been shown to stop the loss of muscle control.
And Biden's new strategy calls out what's, quote, called shrinkflation, blasts big businesses over smaller products. President Joe Biden is going all in on calling out shrinkflation. The term applies to a seemingly covert way for companies to raise prices by ever so slightly reducing the size of their products. There's suddenly fewer pretzels in the bag, less toothpaste in the tube, and shorter candy bars. Biden said in his State of the Union speech on Thursday night, it's called shrinkflation. You get charged the same amount and you got about, 10% fewer Snickers in it? The president's focus on shrinkflation is part of a broader strategy to reframe how voters think about the economy before the November election. Biden is trying to deflect criticism about high prices and instead pin the blame on big business. He's also attempting to show everyday people that he's fighting for them as he struggles to convince the public that the economy has strengthened under his leadership. He talked about the shrinkflation issue in a video released on Super Bowl Sunday and highlighted a social media post by the Sesame Street character Cookie Monster that complained about smaller cookies. The country's low 3.7% unemployment rate and record 16 million applications to start new businesses have largely been overlooked by voters, who are dwelling on higher grocery and housing prices after inflation struck a four-decade high of 9.1% in June of 2022. Even as inflation has drifted down to 3.1% annually, shoppers are still worried about paying a premium. Ryan Bourne, an economist at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, says Joe Biden recognizes that high grocery prices are an Achilles heel politically. When consumers are going into the grocery store, they remember that they're paying more than they did in 2019. But Bourne cautioned that, in the alternative, companies might have to simply raise their list prices without shrinkflation, possibly upsetting consumers more and hurting the president's approval on the issue. Just 34% of adults say they agree with how Biden has handled the economy. This is according to polling by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Bourne says a number of companies did that because they thought that their customers would prefer into paying higher headline prices. So I think the president should be very careful what he wishes for when he says he thinks shrinkflation is not fair. Senator Katie Britt, a Republican from Alabama, delivered the GOP response to the State of the Union and put the blame on inflation solely on Biden. She says his reckless spending dug our economy into a hole and sent the cost of living through the roof, the worst inflation in 40 years. Republicans have claimed that the prices jumped because of Biden's $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package, even though the price increases were also global in nature. That is a sign that the broken supply chains and higher energy and food prices after Russia's invasion of Ukraine played a role. In a report published on Wednesday, the liberal economic advocacy group Groundwork Collaborative dug into the inflation numbers that's published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and documented the evidence of shrinkflation, finding it played a meaningful but modest role in higher prices since 2019. More than 7% of the increase in coffee prices came from reduced packaging. About 10% of higher prices for snacks and household items and paper products came from shrinkflation.
Cancer Moonshot expands to boost access. More than a half dozen large private health insurance companies have agreed to cover the cost of navigators who guide cancer patients and their families through the confusing array of medical appointments and drug treatments that follow a diagnosis. The expansion of the Cancer Navigation Program, part of President Joe Biden's ambitious Cancer Moonshot, is among a handful of health initiatives unveiled last week to coincide with the President's State of the Union address. Advocates say navigators help guide patients and their families through medical appointments and choices they face after a cancer diagnosis. Administration officials cited research that found navigators help reduce wait times between diagnosis and treatment. Patients are also more likely to complete treatment when they work with a navigator. Beginning this year, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced it would cover navigation services for older Americans on Medicare. The agency also established billing codes for hospitals and doctors to bill health insurance companies for navigator services. The Biden administration announced that seven large private health insurance companies have agreed to cover navigator costs: Aetna, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Elevance Health, Health Alliance Plan, Humana, Priority Health, and Select Health. In addition, 40 cancer care centers and clinics will extend navigator services to patients. The list includes high-profile cancer care centers such as Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, the Duke Cancer Institute, Northwell Health, and the Mayo Clinic. This is about making sure that a growing number of Americans can get access as they need it, Aranti Prabhakar, director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, told USA Today. The companies that have signed up to provide health insurance coverage for those services reach 150 million Americans, according to the White House statement. Patient advocates who are familiar with the difficulties of managing a cancer diagnosis in the nation's fragmented healthcare system say navigators play a critical role. Kathy Guisti, a two-time cancer survivor and co-founder of the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, often talks about the challenges patients face after a cancer diagnosis. She described the U.S. healthcare system as vast, fragmented, and challenging, and worries that patients are missing out on the best treatment science is delivering. She said Medicare's coverage of navigators and the broader rollout with the private insurers will help patients. Trained navigators will ease the burden placed on patients and their caregivers, said Guisti, whose book, Fatal to Fearless, 12 Steps to Beating Cancer in a Broken Medical System, describes her cancer journey and provides tips for others. This is a positive short-term solution to a much longer-term problem. Navigators can educate patients on how to advocate for and better coordinate care. Specially trained individuals also can connect patients and their families to social services to address food and housing needs and transportation. Prabhakar said people face so many decisions and challenges after a cancer diagnosis. They have to schedule appointments and arrange transportation. Some patients also seek access to new drugs or treatments being studied in clinical trials. The moment you hear the doctor say the C word, your world starts spinning apart, said Prabhakar, Biden's chief advisor for science and technology. Having a helper by your side brings a measure of calm to a different time. Launched during the Obama administration, the Cancer Moonshot was part of the 21st Century Cures Act, passed in 2016. Biden reinvigorated the effort in 2022 and established goals to cut age-adjusted death rate from cancer by 50% within 25 years and to support patients living with cancer and their caregivers. The American Cancer Society projects 611,720 people will die of cancer this year, a slight increase from its estimate a year ago. The cancer death rate dropped 33% between 1991 and 2021, largely driven by lower smoking rates, earlier detection, and improved treatments. In last week's State of the Union, Biden touted plans to more than double the number of drugs that Medicare can negotiate prices for. His goal is 50 drugs yearly, up from 20 drugs. For the first time, a 2022 federal law has empowered CMS to negotiate lower Medicare drug prices. The Biden administration has named the first 10 diabetes, heart disease, and cancer drugs that Medicare will negotiate. But the price changes on those drugs will not take effect until 2026. Excuse me. The program will ramp up to 15 negotiated drugs in 2027 and 2028, and 20 drugs each year subsequently. Earlier this week, I need a drink of water here. Earlier this week, administration officials announced Biden would ask Congress to limit Medicare patients' out-of-pocket costs to $2 for high-value generic drugs. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services plans to publish a list of proposed $2 generics, such as statins, to treat high cholesterol and beta blockers for high blood pressure. Drug companies and industry allies have filed 9 lawsuits challenging different aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act. Those legal challenges have not delayed the administration's efforts to negotiate cost savings. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade group representing drug manufacturers, said the drug price negotiations threaten drug innovation. The Inflation Reduction Act is what is called a stifling life-saving research. This is the pharmaceutical group called it a stifling life-saving research, like the very research needed to get the president's cancer moonshot off the ground and creating access barriers for patients. That statement came from the pharmaceutical group's president and CEO, Stephen J. Ubley, in a prepared statement.
And this next story is from the Nation and World Extra section on page 4NN. A skier dies during a day of accidents on Mount Washington in New Hampshire. The steep bowl at Tuckerman Ravine on New Hampshire's Mount Washington has long made it a favorite spot for expert skiers and snowboarders who are seeking adventure beyond the comparative safety of the state's ski areas. But hard and icy conditions on Saturday turned the bowl deadly. Madison Saltberg, 20 years old, died after falling about 600 vertical feet down a ravine in the afternoon, according to the U.S. Forest Service. Two other skiers suffered serious injuries after falling and hitting rocks and ice. And there were a number of other falls witnessed throughout the day which didn't result in serious injuries, the service said. A telephone message to a Forest Service spokesperson seeking information about Saltberg wasn't immediately returned Sunday. The day of accidents prompted search efforts that continued for hours in the dark as teams worked to rescue the injured skiers and remove Saltberg's body from the mountain. Heavy, wet snow started to fall on Saturday night and the wind started to pick up, forcing the rescuers to battle on through the worsening conditions. Colleen Mainville, a spokesperson with the U.S. Forestry Service, says the snow ranger and emergency personnel were up there late last night. They are exhausted. Tuckerman Ravine is particularly popular in the spring when the sun begins to soften the snow. On some days, hundreds of skiers and snowboarders make the 3-mile hike to the ravine, resulting in a festive atmosphere. From there, it can take another hour to kick boot steps in the wall to get to the top. But risks, including open ravines, avalanche, and rocks, have resulted in several deaths over the years. The Forest Service says that Saltberg and her skiing companion encountered hard and icy snow surfaces because of cold temperatures and a lack of recent snowfall. There were also open crevasse holes on the mountain, according to the service, and the conditions were unforgiving. Forest Service rangers and a team from Mount Washington Avalanche Center also responded to two other skiers who suffered severe injuries that weren't life-threatening. At 6,288 feet, Mount Washington is the tallest peak in the Northeast and is notorious for its fickle weather. It is a site of frequent rescues. Just the previous night on Friday, a 23-year-old hiker from Kentucky was rescued from that mountain after going off trail and into the... Amonosuk Ravine, according to the New Hampshire Fish and Game. The hiker then fell and hit his head and face, lost one of his sneakers, and eventually became hypothermic. He was given boots, food, warm water, proper winter gear, and a headlamp. He was then escorted back to the trail and then to the Cog Railway parking lot. Another hiker who was rescued from the ravine in February described his 11-hour ordeal to the Associated Press, acknowledging that he had made some poor decisions and was underprepared for his hike, crediting rescuers to saving his life.
And here's a tidbit from the USA Today's science desk. Researchers test ancient gadgets. Tool making has come a long way since the early humans thousands of years ago relied on stone axes and weapons for their survival. Still, Japanese archaeologists wanted to know just how useful those ancient tools were and used precise replicas of those archaic instruments to determine their utility and reliability for our prehistoric ancestors, Cosmos Magazine reported. For their study, a research team created 75 handheld stone axes and adzes using a stone hammer, anvil, and grindstones. They made sure to use minerals found at the time, such as semi-nephrite, hornfels, and tuff, as well as bound them with strips of wood and fibrous grass. All the replicas were made with an average length of 3.82 inches, a width of 2.24 inches, and a thickness of 0.8 inches. The researchers then tested the tools in 15 activities to study macro fractures and micro wear. They used 53 replicas for 10 activities, such as tree felling, wood axing, antler adzing, and bone scraping. Out of these, 26 of them were used until they broke or became dull, while the other 27 were stopped and examined after 500, 1,000, 3,000, and 5,000 strokes. The team also studied wear and tear from 5 non-use activities, such as accidental fractures during production or resharpening. Their findings identified 9 types of macroscopic fractures resulting from various tool uses, as well as different microscopic features associated with specific materials being worked on. The authors added that their analysis can help future archaeologists to identify authentic stone artifacts, as well as determine the time when timber use began.
And we have time for a few news in brief. This one is from Missouri, where a lawyer says a man there thought his mom was an intruder when he shot her. A 25-year-old Missouri man has been charged with shooting and killing his mother as she tried to enter the back door of their home. Jalen Johnson's attorney, William Goldstein, told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that Johnson believed that his mother was an intruder when she tried to enter his home in the St. Louis suburb of Olivet around 7:30 in the morning on Thursday. Olivet police says that 56-year-old Monica McNichols Johnson dined at the house even though Johnson's girlfriend tried to help her after she was shot. Goldstein says the 25-year-old Johnson immediately called 911 after he shot his mother, and he has been distraught since. Goldstein says he hasn't stopped crying. Prosecutors charged Johnson with manslaughter and armed criminal action, and his bail was set at $100,000. Goldstein says that Johnson kept a gun for protection after being robbed at gunpoint before. And with that time remaining, we want to go read a few 50 states. We'll start with some Midwest states. Let me just go down the list here. Let's see. Okay. Illinois, Springfield, a federal complaint has been filed against Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, citing civil rights issues with a scholarship that's offered to plastic surgery residents. And out of Olden, Indiana, a church in Olden helped wipe out $4.1 million in medical debt for nearly 3,000 families. That is more than double of the population in that congregation's own town. Out of Des Moines, Iowa, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has now placed a contaminated site near downtown Des Moines on the National Superfund Priorities List. They're saying a plume of chemicals in the groundwater there threatens central Iowa's water supply. And finally, out of Topeka, Kansas, Attorney General Chris Kobach is suing the social media company TikTok in Shawnee County District Court for allegedly pushing inappropriate content towards children.
And that's then comes caught me by surprise there, Nicole. That's okay. I was just reading. It was also interesting. I was just reading it a little. But maybe you'll get that in the next shift, because the end of our shift is here. For the next 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers will be Jeff Cassett when he arrives and Carol Lockard. And they will continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Now here's Carol with our next article.
Thank you, Scott. Finally, Oscars will let casting directors win, is the title. It's by Jen Rudin. And she is the author of Confessions of a Casting Director, Help Actors Land Any Role with Secrets from Inside the Audition Room, published by HarperCollins, and is the head of voiceover animation at IAG. And here's what she has to say. Casting directors recently achieved a huge victory when the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences finally added a new Oscar category of casting for films released in 2025 and beyond. The first Oscar ceremony was in 1929. The casting director job was created in the 1940s as the Hollywood studio system began dismantling and producers were no longer forced to hire actors on contracts at their studios. The first casting director received on-screen credit in 1972. So, why did it take the Academy almost 100 years to finally recognize our work? The casting director is your first advocate, Oscar winner Marcia Gay Harden told me. And God knows we need many advocates in this business. Casting directors are the first to stand behind you and help push you forward, which is hugely important to an actor. Our rightful place in the creative process. Alan Cumming added, it's great that the Academy is finally acknowledging how essential and integral a casting director's work is. We only think about casting when it's not working so well, and that is a testament to the nuance, care, and dedication to character and story that this group of film community has delivered so often and for so long. Now is their time to be celebrated and for their work to be given its rightful place in the creative process. The casting category is the first new one that the Academy has added since 2001. Marion Doherty, a legendary casting director and the subject of Tom Donahue's influential documentary, Casting By, had advocated for this category since the early 1990s. When Casting By premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2012, it lit the fire to continue the push. In 2013, the Academy added a branch for casting directors to vote. This was a precarious position. We could vote, but not win. It would take another decade to get this new category added. As a child actor in the 1980s, legendary casting director Marcia Shulman gave me my first big break when she cast me in an off-Broadway play when I was 11. By age 12, I had my first epiphany, peering at the casting director from behind my signature purple glasses at final callback for a TV movie. She had identified two groups of kids to present to the ABC executives and the director. As the creative team deliberated over which group to choose, the casting director mediated their conversations and facilitated a calm experience, showing me that the job is a mix of digging deep to discover talent, populating the director's vision by finding the actors to bring the story to life while navigating lots of egos and personalities. Mix in diplomacy and a photographic memory, too. Having spent the past two decades as a casting director for film and television, I have learned it's behind-the-scenes job that takes place long before the cameras roll. Casting is an integral part of the film, like the cinematography, directing, costumes, and sound. Working with the Academy Award-nominated director Peter Bogdanovich to cast his final film, She's Funny That Way, from 2014, I was often the middle person communicating between him and the producers on deadline to hire actors and get everyone to set to make the best possible film. You feel like a bartender, providing choices to the creative team. But even if you know the best option, you must let the director feel they have made the decision. Your role is to bring their vision to life. admire the world the casting director has built. When you see a film and you see the actors the casting directors have curated, the actors they have discovered, the risks that they have encouraged a director to often take, a penny drops about this other essential element of filmmaking. Marcia Gay Harden noted, "Next time you watch a film, admire the world the casting director has built." After watching the Oscar Awards show Sunday, as we celebrate the winners, acknowledge the work of Ellen Lewis and Renee Haynes, who cast Lily Gladstone in Killers of the Flower Moon, and Susan Shopmaker, one of my casting mentors, who discovered Paul Giamatti's young co-star Dominic Sessa in The Holdovers. After decades of demanding recognition for our craft, we will finally be on the red carpet at the Oscars in 2026. Our turn to win. And now, here's Jeff Cassett.
Thank you. Rosie says daylight savings time means saving a meal for later. This opinion piece written by Rex Hupke, who's a columnist for USA Today, but not exactly. In this editor's note, Hupke writes, "I occasionally turn the column over to my exceedingly noble dog, Rosie. Today, Rosie is writing about daylight saving time and its unjust impact on her and her various mealtimes. Hello, humans. Oh, I love you so much. Oh, my God, it's great to see you. Please scratch my tummy. Oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. Sorry, I got too excited and have again humiliated myself. I'm working on that. I've learned that the cruel human invention, daylight saving time, has happened again on Sunday, and on behalf of my friends who are very pleased dogs, very good dogs, I would like to ask that it please stop happening. For dogs, daylight saving time messes up meal time. We dogs do not like this time change thing. To be honest, we don't understand the whole human hang up with time. There is bedtime, awake time, barking at squirrels or random sounds time, rolling on the carpet time, oh no, you're leaving time, and oh thank God you're back time, and most important, food time. My lunchtime is the time you people call noon. I know that time. I know it so well that I routinely remind you by climbing into your lap and licking your face or sitting by my dish staring at you until you can't stand it anymore. Spring forward, that means nothing to dogs. The American Kennel Club, which I do not support because it has the word kennel in its name, explains how dogs view time on its website. Most researchers who study dogs do not believe they grasp the concept, but they do perceive the passage of time and will definitely let you know when it's time for them to eat. Now, I don't mean to sound like a bad dog. Remember, I am the one who's a good dog. It's me. It's me. But when you humans observe your very weird daylight saving time holiday, it means that the time when my bowl is filled with wondrous kibble happens 1 hour, human hour, earlier. Don't get me wrong. I like that. But I'm going to assume that it's just an appetizer being awarded to me for being a good dog, as previously mentioned. How do you think I'm going to feel when it's the time of my internal clock and it says it's mealtime? I'm going to want my meal. And if that means second dinner, so be it. Me and my good dog colleagues will never understand these time switches. Our thought process when breakfast or dinner, or in cases of very good dogs like myself, lunch, comes more than 1 second after the normal time is, where is my food? Where is my food? Where is my food? Okay, I guess there will never be any food provided to me ever again. I'm probably going to starve to death, but I will sit here for a while just in case. How long has it been? It feels like a lifetime. Hey, wait, I have no concept of time. Oh, dog, I'm so hungry, so hungry, I will start whining now. Why has my human forsaken me? The bottom line, kind humans, is we do not like daylight saving time. It is a very bad time. In fact, we would like to bite it or chase it up a tree and bark at it angrily. Might we persuade you to feed us twice, 1 hour apart? There is an equitable solution. If, for example, my dinner time is 7 p.m., which it is, and I love it so much. Now that your daylight saving time has hit, you should feed me at 6 p.m., which is the new version of 7 p.m. Yay! Bonus dinner! But then, for the sake of consistency and because I am such a good girl, you should feed me again at the new 7 p.m., which would be your post-daylight saving time, 8 p.m. If you do the same for breakfast and lunch, we should be covered. And I will not stress about my eating time, and you will not stress about me being stressed, since I know you love me so much, although not nearly as much as I love you. Oh my God, you are fantastic. Please scratch my butt. Sorry, I got excited again. I hope you will accept this humble recommendation. And I also hope you will give me a treat right now because I am staring at you in a manner deserving of a treat. Sincerely, Rosie, such a very good girl.
That was a really cute article. Thank you, Jeff. And now we'll go to sports and start off with something that you can watch or listen to on TV. Sports on TV, and this is for today, Monday, March 11th, and the times that I give you will be Central Standard Time. So, college basketball, this is the men's, at 5 p.m. tonight, will be on CBSSN, Colonial Athletic Tournament, Monmouth, Charleston winner, whoever is the winner of that one, versus Towson and UNC Wilmington winner. Washington, D.C. At 7 p.m. on ESPN, the Southern Tournament, Samford Furman winner versus ETSU Chattanooga winner. This is for the championship in Asheville, North Carolina. On ESPN2 at 6 p.m., Sunbelt Tournament, Appalachian State versus Arkansas State winner versus Texas St. James Madison winner. This is for the championship, Pensacola, Florida. Also at 6 o'clock tonight, ESPNU Horizon League Tournament, Cleveland State versus Oakland, Michigan, semifinal in Indianapolis. Tonight at 8:30 p.m., this is still for men's college basketball, at 7:30 on CBSSN, Colonial Athletic Tournament, Stony Brook Drexel winner versus Delaware Hofstra winner in Washington, D.C. And at 8 p.m. on ESPN, West Coast Tournament, Santa Clara versus St. Mary's, California, semifinal in Las Vegas. At 8:30 tonight, ESPN2 Horizon League Tournament, UW and Milwaukee versus Northern Kentucky, semifinal Indianapolis. At 10:30, ESPN2 West Coast Tournament, San Francisco versus Gonzaga, semifinal in Las Vegas. And now to the women's college basketball. At 12:30 today, CBSSN Summit League Tournament, South Dakota and St. Thomas winner versus South Dakota State semifinals, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. At 1 p.m. on ESPNU, Sunbelt Tournament, Marshall and Old Dominion winner versus James Madison and Louisiana winner, championship game, Pensacola, Florida. At 1:30 p.m., ESPN2, Big 12 Tournament, Iowa State versus Oklahoma semifinal in Kansas City, Missouri. At 3 p.m. on CBSSN, Summit League Tournament, Oral Roberts, North Dakota winner versus North Dakota State. Semifinals, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. At 4 p.m., ESPN2, Big 12 Tournament, Kansas State versus Texas, semifinal, Kansas City, Missouri. At 6 p.m. tonight, FS1, Big East Tournament, UConn Marquette winner versus Creighton Georgetown winner. This is for the championship. UNCasville, Connecticut. College softball is the next category. At 6 p.m. tonight, SECN, Florida at Alabama. For MLB baseball, at noon today, MLBN, spring training, Pittsburgh versus Boston in Fort Myers, Florida. At 3 p.m. today, MLBN, spring training, LA Dodgers versus Cleveland. And that's Goodyear, Arizona. And next category is NBA basketball. At 7 p.m. tonight, NBA TV, Golden State at San Antonio. 10:30 tonight, NBA TV, Boston at Portland. Next category is NHL hockey. At 6 p.m. tonight, NHLN, New Jersey at New York Rangers. And women's soccer at 3 this afternoon, USA Premier League, Newcastle United at Chelsea. And our final category is tennis. At 1 p.m. on tennis, BNP Paribas Open, ATP WTA third round, Indian Wells, California. And the final is at 9 p.m. tennis, again, BNP Paribas Open, ATP /WTA third round, Indian Wells, California.
In other sports news, men's college basketball, the Drake Bulldogs won the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament, and that puts them automatically in the big dance, the NCAA tournament, which starts in a couple of weeks. And on the women's side, Iowa gets rolling in the second half to win the Big Ten tournament. The droves who came in black and gold arrived on Championship Sunday, expecting to end this magical weekend with a spirited celebration. Four quarters and more of vintage March tension certainly wasn't on this Iowa women's basketball agenda. Yet, as is the case in Lincoln, as was the case in Lincoln a month ago, Nebraska hardly budged despite the Hawkeyes' elite prowess and support on the other side. From the opening jump, the Huskers intended to insert an unplanned script into this Big Ten tournament final. It didn't matter that opposing noise came raining down at just about every possible moment. It was only after number 2 seed Iowa forced an improbable overtime period that Lisa Bluter's veteran bunch finally found its footing, and it took longer than expected to turn Target Center into a festive scene. But the Hawkeyes' 94-89 win that clinched a third straight Big Ten tournament title signaled a fitting end to another massive weekend in the spotlight. It was really gritty and resilient out of our group. That was the biggest thing, said tournament MVP Caitlin Clark, who circled back after a tough start to finish with 34 points and multiple clutch shots down the stretch. She said, obviously, the first half, we were just very out of sorts in all sorts of ways. Whether it was on defense, whether it was offensively, we just found a way to win, and that speaks to the team that we have, the maturity that we have in this group. Four grueling quarters plus an extra period Iowa was fortunate to get tested the Hawkeyes veterans' mettle at every corner. It wasn't until Clark's tray with 51 seconds remaining in overtime, which handed the Hawkeyes an 89-87 lead they didn't relinquish, that those in the building finally felt this day would end the way it was supposed to. Gabby Marshall's block and steal, plus two more Hannah Stelke free throws moments after the first two misses of the tournament, officially removed all drama. Just getting to overtime, though, was draining enough. The Hawkeyes sat in a 75-67 hole with 2 minutes and 38 seconds left, and life evaporated quickly before ripping off a 10-2 surge that saw Clark and Kate Martin drain pivotal trays to keep Iowa afloat. A Clark driving layup knotted the game at 77 with 29 seconds left. The building roared with jubilation after a hard-earned defensive stop followed. Clark said, "Our fans, they were incredible. They kind of willed us to this victory. They never gave up on us. We never gave up on each other. Things weren't always pretty. Things weren't always great, especially in the first half. I didn't shoot the ball well. You've just got to wipe it, let it go, come back and respond. I think the biggest thing was that we started running our offense in the second half. It was a lot better. It was a lot cleaner. We got good looks. We made a few more shots." Climbing back within striking distance in the second half required an uptick in Iowa's defensive intensity that was non-negotiable. It finally arrived in the third quarter, just in time for Iowa to wind the building's energy back up for the closing 10 minutes. The Hawkeyes held Nebraska scoreless for about 4 minutes while forcing the Huskers into 10 consecutive misses, allowing Iowa to slow play an 8-0 run that supplied its first lead since the opening stretch. Momentum had finally been secured after chasing it for nearly three quarters. "We fought hard tonight, and we had to," Bluter said. "It's not very often we have fought from behind this season. That was our biggest deficit at halftime. We just tried to reset at halftime. I thought they came out, and that third quarter was really good." It was a needed push, given how poorly the opening act went. The vibrant energy that permeated Target Center on Friday and Saturday quickly vanished once Nebraska made it clear it wasn't wilting in this moment. A small red contingent behind the Huskers' bench belted out praise while the black and gold around it wallowed in this unexpected tension. Visible frustration replaced the wide smile usually plastered on Clark's face as she again fought through a frigid opening half that saw Iowa's top weapon miss all nine of her first half three-pointers. 4 points on 2-for-13 shooting is what Clark carried into the locker room. But unlike Friday, there was no immediate team-wide reassurance that everything would work out. A 46-35 halftime deficit offered up several concerning signs. But as Iowa fans headed home feeling the same way after a whirlwind afternoon, it was a huge buildup and they got really happy and excited. Carol?
Thanks, Jeff. And now on to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, on paper, I'm an accomplished woman. I have a doctorate in educational leadership and had a 36-year career in education, mostly as a school administrator. I am financially stable, and I have many friends. I also have an overwhelming sense of loneliness, and this is where my issues lie. I was well accepted when I lived in the North, but since moving to Florida, I've had trouble breaking into volunteerism. It took 5 years before I was accepted for volunteer jobs in my community, and only because of a board member's intervention. I've been told there are no openings on certain committees until they hear my background from someone. I joined a philanthropy group, which cost me more than $1,000 a year, and as often as they ask for volunteers, I am never accepted. Recently, there was a social event sponsored by this group. I was not invited. I learned of it only when someone offered me a ride. When I asked my doctor for the name of someone I could talk to, as the fault must lie with me, he was dismissive. I am sinking further into loneliness and don't know what to do. Do you have any suggestions? Signed, Off Track in Stuart, Florida. Abby says, Dear Off Track, are you affiliated with a religious institution in your community? If so, it might benefit you to talk with the clergy person and ask why you may have been excluded from volunteering. In most communities, there is a crying need for people to donate their time and help. If that conversation does not provide insight regarding the attitude toward new arrivals in town, it may be time to consider relocating to a more welcoming city, one with opportunities for folks who would like to share their time and talents. P.S. If there are more Northerners like yourself who have been pushed aside, consider forming a group of your own and socializing with them. You might make some more wonderful friends if you do. A second letter. Dear Abby, I am a male, 75 years old, happily married for 45 years. We are in good health. We had two kids, a wonderful daughter who has given us two beautiful grandkids, and a son who we unfortunately lost to cancer 20 years ago. My problem is I have bad dreams. Sometimes they border on nightmares, and I don't understand why. If I have 100 dreams, 99 are bad. Two nights ago, I woke up screaming from one of them. I have no stress. We are financially secure, and life is good. I've spoken to two professionals about this, and there are no answers to my problem. Have you ever heard of this, and do you have any advice? Signed, Bad Nights in New Jersey. And Abby says, Dear Bad Nights, I've heard of this in connection with PTSD, with the clear understanding that I am not licensed to practice medicine or psychotherapy in any state of the U.S., I'll share my take on what's happening to you. I've been told that dreams can be a way to our unconscious to try to work out problems or trauma, which might include the untimely death of your son. I am sorry you didn't mention what kind of doctors you've consulted about your nightmares. Some sessions with a licensed psychotherapist with expertise in the treatment of PTSD might be helpful in solving your problem. Jeff?
Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.